We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovix. Joining me today is Don Durrett, author of How to Invest in Gold and Silver, investor and contributor to Seeking Alpha, and also the founder of goldstockdata.com. How are you today, Don?
Great. Thanks for having me back, Tom.
Great to have you as always. So, you know, over the last couple of weeks, you were kind of on my mind, and I wanted to get your take on if the miners were really confirming the run that we saw in the metals prices and how you see that relationship working.
No, the miners haven't confirmed. The HUI is over 300, which is kind of a positive number. But back in 2011, the HUI was over 600. So it's only at 50% of where it should be. So the sentiment has been terrible in miners. And I don't know when it really switched around 2012, 13, 14, when gold started going down and the miners, you know, we had a lot of bankruptcies because a lot of companies thought they were going to, you know, make a lot of money because gold was, you know, trending up from 2007 up. And so you had a lot of investment. And then 2013, 14, 15, we had the crash in gold and we had a lot of bankruptcies, had a lot of miners go down, you know, 70, 90%. And the sentiment kind of went in the dumper, and it's never come back. And so right now, you know, I was looking at some stocks today, the multiples, what they're at and what they should be at. And these companies are all selling at half price, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got Yamana with a free cash flow multiple under 10. And there's a lot of companies, you know, majors that are that way. They should have multiples. I mean, at $2,000 gold, they should have multiples of 20. So you're getting them at a half price right now, and the HUI should be double what it's at 600. So the miners have not haven't started playing yet. They're not following the gold price. It's almost as if investors think that this is a fake breakout. I mean, I think gold right now, the miners are trading as if gold's at maybe 1600, 1700. So, you know, it's been tough for mine investors, but silver hasn't confirmed yet. So, you know, I think this real breakout is going to be when, you know, gold has been over 1950 now for 2 weeks. Today it's under 1950, but we have a couple more days to go here in this week. I think it'll close the week over 1950. We'll see. But silver needs to get over 2850, in my opinion. A lot of people think it's already broken out. It's already confirmed. But if you look at the chart, if you look at the silver chart, it really, for it to get into the blue sky territory, if you will, here for this correction, it really needs to get over 2850. I think once that happens, the silver chart is so potent, so powerful, that I think it'll run over 30 fairly quickly. I would think within a week. It gets over 2850. I think it'll be over 30 within a week. Once it gets over 30, I think you're going to have a ton of money move into the miners, kind of confirming it. Confirmations are big. They're really important. And then if you have silver over 30 and you have gold over 2000, I think then we're going to see the HUI really rock and roll. I think we could see the HUI jump over 400 fairly quickly. And then if that happens, then yeah, then we're back. We're really run. Then they're running. They're off to the races. And then who knows how far this bull market, this bull run could go based on all of issues, back information, you know, Ukraine, U.S. economy, inflation, all of these macro numbers, they're all supporting gold. So we could have a really historic, epic market right now. We'll see. Mm-hmm.
So you've said that breakout zone of 1950 is, you know, a really important line in the sand. So do we need a weekly close there or a monthly close to really confirm that move?
Well, for me, I like to see two weekly closes two Friday weekly closes above a breakout number. We've had that in gold. So I think gold has broken out. I don't see us going back under, you know, 1950 and 1900, you know, back into the 1800s and, you know, languishing. No, I think gold has broken out here and is getting ready to really move, if you will. It's silver. We just need to, once that confirmation comes with silver, I think it's off to the races. But I do think that my feeling is that gold has broken out. And I don't think that there's anything that can, at this, in the first half of this year, that can push it back down, say below 1800. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for instance, there's really only two things that really hurt gold. And the one is that you have a massive beat down and investors sell everything. So like 2008, when we had that crash and gold and silver just got hammered, you know, during the sell-off. Right. And we've had, lately we've had these, you know, the S&P's down 12% right now and gold's at over 1900. So the sell-off in the markets has not been hurting gold. So even if the S&P goes down 20%, I don't see gold going below 1850. 1800 is kind of my line in the sand. And it wouldn't shock me if we don't even go to 1850, but somewhere in there, 1825, 1850 kind of looks like the bottom to me. And it looks like it's short lived. So we're getting higher bottoms here for gold in the first half of this year. And so the second thing that can push down gold, which I don't see that happening in the first half of the year, is a strong economy. So if you get a strong economy, then nobody wants to own gold and gold languishes. I mean, that's your 2012, 13, 14, 15 scenario where the economy came back to life. Not strongly, but it came back a little bit. And the Fed was injecting money into the economy, getting growth, and gold languished, right? So you get a semblance of strength in the economy. Those are the only two factors that really are going to hurt you in gold and silver and in the mining area. In the first half of this year, we have the wind at our back. And so we have to wait until June. We get to June and then we can see out about 6 months. My vision is about 6 months. I can see out about 6 months. That's about it. So we get to June, we look out another 6 months, and we're going to have an idea of where inflation's going. We're going to have an idea of where the U.S. economy is going. If the U.S. economy does not grow between now and June, then gold will probably be, you know, kind of well over 2,000 in June, I would think, because growth right now in the U.S. economy is flat. It's probably, you know, 1% or less. And so if it doesn't pick up between now and June, and then inflation, that's the other one. So if inflation, I don't see inflation going below 5% in the first half of the year. So we get to June, we look out, if inflation is going to stay above 5% and the economy is going to be weakened, then H2 is going to start looking good for gold. And then, you know, then your bull market. So we're at the beginning of a resumption of the bull market. So we've been in a 17-month, 18-month correction in gold, which we're just breaking out of now. Silver's close to getting ready to break out of its correction. It looks like, I think silver might take about a month later, which is amazing. I mean, they're both breaking out at the same time. If you go back to the actual breakout, gold broke out in 2019. June 2019. Silver didn't break out until July 2020. It waited a year, 13 months later. So now instead of 13 months, we're going to get a 1 month. So they're basically coming. They both corrected in August, right? August 2020, they corrected. So now it looks like they're going to break out together. They corrected together. They're going to break out together. So once that happens, we get to June. Late spring, and you know, we're already in the middle of March, you know, April, May, we're going to have a real good feeling here about this breakout, about, you know, how strong it's going, you know, the miners really rocking and rolling. So, you know, we have to keep an eye on inflation, the U.S. economy, and of course, Ukraine has a huge impact here on gold. Huge, huge. I can't emphasize how important this Ukraine invasion is on the price of gold going forward. It's pretty stunning. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, kind of in that vein, Don, we saw the fear trade kick in and really drive demand for physical for the last you know, about a month and a half, you know, even over and above, let's say, the beginning of COVID 2 years ago. So do you think that fear trade is still in place for the majority of people yet disconnected from the market?
Well, I'm a big believer that fear and uncertainty are the number one driver of gold. Some people think that interest rates and the dollar are just as important as uncertainty. But I think that the one thing that, for me as a gold investor and a mining investor, the one thing that I want to see is all-time highs. I want to see big runs. And the only thing that creates big runs, in my opinion, is the threat of systemic risk. The systemic risk doesn't have to actually happen. We don't actually have to have a crash, you know, a Lehman. All you need is the threat of it, you know, a Lehman Brothers type thing, the Ukraine type thing, or, you know, COVID, you know, creating inflation, which could roll over into the financial markets. You just need the threat of systemic risk. And I think that COVID created that through expansion of the money supply by 40%, which has created the inflation that we have today. You know, Biden says that the only thing that's causing it is supply chain issues. You know, it was a complete joke. Supply chain have exacerbated it, but it didn't cause it.
Now it's Russia, though.
Yeah, now they're pivoting over and blaming Russia for inflation. Mm-hmm. Whereas inflation started last summer. I started, you know, what, 9 months ago was when inflation really kicked in. You know, Russia wasn't even close to invading then. So inflation is the driver, one of the drivers here. Now you made me lose my train of thought. The question.
Sorry about that, Don. That's why I try not to interrupt.
Okay. Wait, we're talking about the fear trade. Now I got it back. I forgot what the question was. We're talking about the fear trade. Okay, so uncertainty is increasing. So if you go back to the last gold run from 2001 to 2011, it's my opinion that the fear trade is what drove gold from 250 to 1900. So what was that fear trade? It was 9/11. 9/11 damaged this country significantly. It put us into a recession. And then on top of that, then the Fed had to start printing money and lowering interest rates, basically changing kind of the dynamic of the free market. If you look back, the free market actually died. You could say that it started dying in 97, 98, 99, when we started having big time manipulation. And then 2001 was kind of the coup de grace of the free market. And so 2001, that's when the markets became unsettled. So $250 gold no longer made sense. So when 9/11 hit, gold was $250. I mean, it was super cheap. Gold didn't matter. It was a non-issue. But then the free market started to break and people started buying gold. And that was, to me, it was this fear of systemic risk. And then we talked about the Great Recession in 2007, 8, 9. That's when people were really, really afraid. They're like, you know, this whole thing could have burned to the ground kind of thing. That's systemic risk at its best, right? And that fear trade increased. It started with 9/11. The fear trade kicked in. Gold started trending higher. And then it exploded after the Great Recession because the fear trade increased. Uncertainty increased, the risk. You know, how are we going to fix this problem? And we were printing money. You know, we were bailing people out left and right. You know, prior to 9/11, the Fed never had much on its balance sheet. Never. I mean, less than a trillion. It never did. And then all of a sudden, now their balance sheet's growing. They're bailing out insurance companies and banks. And, you know, the world changed. The world changed in 2001, and then it changed again in 2007, 8, 9. We adopted MMT, basically. Mm-hmm. We decided that debt no longer was a top priority. So deficits no longer mattered. and we're still there. And MMT is a very slippery slope. Once you adopt it, it basically gets worse and worse and worse. And that's what's happened today. Now, I mean, they just signed a big budget and nobody even, it wasn't even on the news. I mean, it's like 1.5 trillion, you know, and the deficit is going to be over a trillion and nobody blinks, right? $1 trillion deficit, nobody blinks. And back in the 1990s, we were scared to death of a $100 billion deficit. I don't know if people remember that. The Newt Gingrich era in the mid-early 90s, they actually balanced the budget because of fear of deficits. We had a balanced budget. I think it was 98, 99. Because of fear of deficits, right? Now we have a $1 trillion deficit and we don't even blink. It's a completely, we flip. Like I said, late 90s, early 2000s, we changed our economic system. And now that economic system is imploding, and now it's transitioning into something completely different. And so the uncertainty level, so that fear trade, it ended in 2012 because people started believing that MMT was going to work, that the Fed was going to be able to manage the economy. It was going to be able to create growth, limit inflation. Basically, we had it all, you know, everybody thought, you know, no problem. But it was a mirage because it was fake growth. It was manipulated growth. It was all done through printed money, stimulus. And you can look at the growth of the money supply right alongside the stock market. They were both going up parabolically. Whenever they put on the brakes a little bit on the money supply, the stock market would falter a little bit, like 2016. And then they would put the foot on the metal, on the gas, and inject money into the system, and the stock market would come back. Basically, they started manipulating the stock market from 2012 to 20, all the way to now. The stock market has been manipulated. It's no longer a free market. It's no longer, it's all broken. And now the fear trade hasn't completely come back, but it's on the verge. Some people say it has, but I would say no. I still think that Wall Street at this time still is bullish. Wall Street still believes in the Fed. Wall Street still believes the economy is coming back. Most people on Wall Street are still focused, are analyzing their stocks, looking for the best investments. They're not going to work with the type of mentality that I'm talking about, this fear uncertainty trade. It's not their mindset. Their mindset on Wall Street right now is that everything's coming back to normal. The US economy is the best in the world. We're going to start growing again. GDP is going to go back to, you know, 2% plus. Everything's going to be fine. We're going to get our bonuses in December. I have a great profession. I trade on Wall Street. All that. No fear. The fear trade hasn't returned quite yet. Mm-hmm. But I think it's right around the corner. Right around the corner.
So, Don, I'd like to go back to what you were talking about, kind of touching on inflation. How much do you see the supply chain and commodity shortage issues adding to inflation? And, you know, going forward, are we going to be crashing part of the inflation story while the other half is rising, let's say by housing prices coming back down or something like that?
It's really difficult to know how much supply chain issues are impacting inflation. You know, I don't think anybody can really model that or figure that one out. What we do know is we're getting the Cantillon effect, where when you print money, when the government prints money, people closer to the money, they get it first. And so they get to spend it first, but then that money slowly filters out to the public. And as it filters out, that's when you get inflation. So inflation is always delayed, if you will. So all this money printing they did right when COVID hit, that money all went to Wall Street, the people who were close to the money. And so the asset prices went nuts, but the inflation was kind of delayed. And then it finally started kicking into gear last summer. We finally went to 5%. And so that Cantillon effect is still happening. That money is still filtering into society, but the supply chain is exacerbating the inflation. The one thing that's kind of the wild card here is the velocity of money is kind of really, really, really slow, and that's the reason. That's why it takes a long time for this money to get out into society. because the money just sticks in the banks. You know, the banks are hoarding it. They get, it's like free money for them with this low interest rate. So they don't loan it out. And they're basically doing overnight loans to themselves, to, you know, the Fed. That's called those reverse repos. They're literally loaning money to the Fed and getting paid overnight instead of loaning money to businesses. That slows down the velocity of money. So we have a really slow velocity of money. So it's hard to predict. And then the other thing that we don't have is we don't have a wage price spiral where prices go up and then wages go up too. We're not having that. Last month, wage increases were basically flat. And we actually have negative, at this point in time, we have negative wage growth because inflation is going up. Inflation is going up higher than wages. We have, basically, it's negative. So that doesn't create, you know, that doesn't really add to inflation because people have less money to spend. They're not going to spend it. So they're going to be more apt to, well, they're probably going to spend everything they have, you know, because people are living paycheck to paycheck, but they're not, it's not really causing additional inflation per se because they don't have excess money. Mm-hmm. So it slows down. So I think that inflation, I never expected hyperinflation. Unless the Fed kind of gets nuts, and we can talk about this, about the Fed defaulting on their debt, if they're going to have an option here, and that's about hyperinflation, but I don't think it's going to happen. But as far as in the near term, I think inflation is probably going to stay about where it's at. It might go up just a little bit, but I think it's going to kind of be range bound for this year, you know, kind of in the 8% to 12%. Now, the Fed says we're at 7%, right? But who believes that? So it's higher. So if I say 8%, I'm probably way too low, but it's probably somewhere 8% to 12%. Some people say it's much higher than that, but it depends. Each person is impacted by inflation differently. It depends on what you have to spend your money on. If you spent the majority of your money on food and gas, then your inflation is higher than mine. Mm-hmm. It depends on the percentage of money. I mean, I work full time from home, so I don't drive a lot. So I don't have a much of a gasoline bill. So I'm not getting impacted by gas prices. But the people that are commuting to work, you know, they're getting hit really hard here. And so, you know, it depends on what your budget is, how inflation is hitting you. But I don't see hyperinflation. I don't see inflation. I think food inflation is going up this year, no doubt in my mind. Food inflation is going to go higher, which is going to impact, like I said, these people that are living paycheck to paycheck. They're spending most of their money on a big chunk of their money. And then rents up high. So between rent, food, energy, those three, you know, people are, they're feeling the pinch, if you will, which creates recessions. We had three recessions in the 70s and early 80s from recession. Last time we had high inflation, we had three. Inflation causes recessions. And what I just explained is the reason why is because the discretionary spending, it dries up. And if you don't have discretionary spending, that means that small businesses aren't getting any money because people don't have any excess money to go to these small businesses and keep them thriving. So that's the reason. And I'm expecting a recession this year.
And I've heard you say that the Fed is trying to avoid a recession versus fighting inflation. So this seems like those two goals would be, you know, really opposed to each other. So which one do you think is more important at this point to the Fed?
That I love that question. That's my favorite question you've given me today. You're absolutely spot on. So the Fed has, they pivoted in 2001 to MMT. They basically decided to copy Japan. So Japan throughout the 1990s, if anybody was remembered that period of time, if anybody was around 89, 90, 91, 92, the U.S. government was trying to put pressure on Japan to let their corporations go bankrupt. They're basically going, you just crashed. You have to reset your economy. You need to reset it. And we put so much pressure on Japan to do that. And Japan basically said, no, we're going to do something different. Something that really hasn't really been done before. we're just going to print money and bail everybody out and pretend that that nobody went bankrupt. And we're going to start buying all these treasuries. We're going to take interest rates to zero, which has never been done before. They took their short-term rates and then they took their 10-year rate to zero. And then they started buying all the bonds to keep them at zero to stimulate the economy. And then they wouldn't let any corporation go bankrupt. They became zombies. And now the United States has like 15% of our corporations are zombies because we did the same thing they did. We're not letting our corporations die. So amazingly, because they generate income from trade. So they're a creditor nation where we're a debtor nation. Mm-hmm. They were able to keep their yen somewhat strong and they were able to keep their inflation down. And in fact, it got in the 90s where they couldn't create inflation. And so everybody was watching what they were doing. MMT came out of that. It was like, well, we had to give it a label. So we basically gave it a label, modern monetary theory. And so this idea of keeping interest rates really low and making sure that the economy has lots of liquidity. And so that's what we did. So the Fed, we in 2001, we pivoted very small, you know, it was a small pivot. And then it really kicked into gear in 2008. And now it's really, really kind of going, you know, full speed. We're Japan too. So when you have MMT, you can't have a recession. Because if you have a recession, the debt bubble can basically blow up on you. You have to have low interest rates. If you don't have low interest rates, you have a problem. MMT demands low interest rates. And so, you know, and so what do? They if they raise rates, they're going to create a recession, and then the recession is going to blow up your debt, your debt. Remember, debt's not supposed to matter in MMT. It's not supposed to matter, but it starts to matter once interest rates go up. And so the Fed is somewhat trapped. They have to raise rates a little bit in order to make sure that inflation doesn't get out of control. And they also have to raise rates, ironically, for political reasons, right? Mm-hmm. You have a Democrat in the White House right now. Who has a bit of he has the bully pulpit, he has the microphone, right? He wants to make sure that the Fed is doing their job. They have not raised rates one time, not once. They have not raised rates since this whole thing started. We've had high inflation since the last summer. Since June of last year, we've had high interest rates. They started calling it transitory. Transitory, and everybody's laughing at them. And here it is, all these months later, and they still haven't raised rates. Why, right? You have to ask yourself, why? Well, mm-hmm. Why is because of MMT. A recession could literally blow up the financial system. We can't afford to have a recession. Mm-hmm. So what are they going to do? But politically, they have to raise rates because if they don't, people that are paying these high gasoline bills, these high food bills that I talked about, who are paying paycheck to paycheck and are basically their standard of living is going down, they want some type of relief. And the only way they get it is if the Fed raises rates to slow this inflation. I mean, historically, that's how it works. You slow the economy, slow inflation, you raise rates, put on the brakes. But the Fed is like, oh my God, we don't want to do that, but we have to do it. So they are going to raise rates in March. Powell's been emphatic, and the reason why is because politically he has to. He doesn't want to. As far as he's concerned, he'd prefer inflation. Let's let inflation, you know, let it go. We'll keep the economy growing. The economy is more important because if the economy dies, then the financial system could die. So what they're going to do is they're going to raise rates a little bit. I don't know how high they'll get. You know, who is it? JP Morgan says they're going to go all the way to 2.5%, but we're all laughing at JP Morgan saying there's no way they're getting to 2.5. I don't think they'll get to one. My guess is they'll get to 0.5 or 0.75, and then recession will kick into gear and they'll take it back to zero. And they'll basically say, look, we don't have a choice. The economy, we can't let the economy crash. We have to go rates back to zero. Mm-hmm. And the reason why they'll have to go back to zero is because it makes no sense at all And this is where it gets real interesting. This is where they really screwed up when they went down the MMT path, went down the MMT road. And I've been saying that, you know, that this type of economic system is fantasy. And this is where that this is where it the rubber really hits the road, is that the Fed has to inject liquidity into the system. If a liquidity dries up, the financial system collapses. They have to inject liquidity. That MMT requires it. So it makes absolutely zero sense to inject liquidity and raise rates at the same time. It doesn't make any sense at all. You have to do one or the other. If you're going to raise rates, then you have to basically pull the liquidity out. But they can't pull the liquidity out. So what they'll do is they'll raise rates, then they'll take it back to zero, and then they'll inject liquidity because they have to inject liquidity. If they don't inject liquidity, it's lights out. That's the problem with MMT. Once you get into this type of scenario, all choices become bad. And that's where we're at right now. All choices are bad. And to make it even worse, this scenario was already set up because of their money printing without Ukraine. We haven't talked about Ukraine. It was set up in motion prior to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Now what's going to happen? Now they have even worse choices. Now, this is how bad it's gotten. It's gotten so bad now that the U.S. is going to have to speed up its transition into a new financial system. They don't want to do it. It's a terrible time. They don't have a choice. So now the only thing they can do is the Fed is going to try to manage the transition. It's going to be fascinating what happens this decade. That's all I can say, because the transition is going to be painful, because it's going to create a lot of winners and losers. And they don't have a choice. They can't create all losers, right? That won't work.
So Don, before we dig into the, you know, this new monetary system, I just wanted to ask if that rate raising and, you know, subsequent market crash is going to cause that fear trade that you were saying, you know, at the end of one of your other answers, that is right around the corner.
Right. So we're not going to have a crash. And the reason we're not going to have a crash is because of technology. A lot of people think, you know, we're going to crash. But look at how, what we did during COVID. Everybody worked from home with no problem. Why was that possible? Technology, the internet, computers, software. Technology is increasing at a rapid rate. And it's going to continue to increase at a rapid rate because of basically sharing of information. So you have technology, I think, is going to keep things. This is why I say there's going to be winners and losers. We're not going to have growth, but we're not going to have crash, and we're not going to crash either. We're not going to have a depression. We're not going to have a collapse. But we are going to have, you know, a lot of fallout. We are going to have inflation. We are going to have lack of growth in the economy, lack of growth in the stock market. I call it muddling. I think it's kind of going to be like the lost decade that Japan had. Mm-hmm. From 90 to 2000, where basically they had no growth. That's what it's going to happen to us. I mean, I think that's what the lesson of MMT teaches us, is that once you take interest rates to zero, you basically can't grow. Because the reason why is because the market, once you kill the market, then, you know, the free market is what creates growth. And once you kill the free market, you kill growth. And so I think that's what's going to happen. The growth is going to basically come to a standstill. So if growth comes to a standstill, that's going to be messy. There's going to be a lot of companies that close their doors, and there'll be new companies that open theirs. A lot of transition. You know, I don't know. It's hard to predict exactly what's going to happen. You know, but I think that the transition is going to create a new economic system and possibly a new political system by the end of this decade. We'll look back at the change and just be in wonder. I watched Luke Grohman's podcast yesterday with Grant Williams, and it was amazing. And the reason I'm bringing it up here is because I think this is pertinent to what's my answer, mm-hmm. and that he says that the financial system that was created after World War II was based on the US dollar, and that we're currently, that's, and it's no longer working, and that we're currently transitioning away from that into more of a neutral, where you have one country dominating kind of the global currency trade, that we're going to go to some type of a neutral currency. And he thinks that that neutral currency will be commodity based. It might be a combination of currencies and commodities, but I think that we are going to transition away from the dollar and into some type of a neutral currency, so that people, countries can buy energy, any other types of imports using this neutral commodity or their own, their, and a lot of these countries are going to use their own currencies and basically kind of step away from the dollar. Now, if that happens, that's going to hurt the U.S. economy. The U.S. economy right now has an advantage over the rest of the world in that we can print money. We can literally export money. And right now there's, you know, trillions of dollars of these these countries are holding on FX reserves of U.S. dollars because the dollar is what we use for trade. Like the SWIFT system, which all the countries use for trade, is all done in dollars. So if we're transitioning away from SWIFT, that is not going to be a free ride for the U.S. If that, and I think that's going to happen early in this decade, not late in this decade, early. And so that's going to be painful. So we're looking at, and that's the fear trade. So once we start going into this transition, that's systemic failure. So that's where I think gold, and I've been saying this, you know, people have been, and when I created my website in 2012, I used $100 silver as my future valuation for silver miners. And people give me a bad time ever since. That doesn't make any sense. That's way too high. I will never get there. Well, now look at the world. You know, I think if you could, 6 months, silver could easily be at $50, you know, and then you're looking, 50, 100 isn't that far away. And then gold. And, you know, my target has always been $3,000 gold, and I use $2,500 for my valuations. And now we're at $2,000. We're getting really close to $2,500. So the fear trade, if it does kick in, and I think it will, and I think the dollar is a really big component of that, and the U.S. economy is a bigger component of that, and MMT is a big component of that. And so everything you look at, I don't see any arguments against gold and silver over for this decade. I think all the arguments seem to be pretty pro precious metals at this point in time.
So Don, do you think that new monetary system that is, you know, basically an international currency that isn't necessarily tied to one particular country, what do you think the probabilities are that it ends up being a CBDC type of currency? Or is that, you know, in particular countries, and then on top of that, we'll have an international trading currency?
I don't think that's far-fetched. I think that digital currencies are on the rise, and that it's the trend. I mean, I've been, you know, pro-crypto since 2016, when I basically did my research on it. And I think that, you know, crypto is a new technology in the financial world that's going to grow and expand. And the CBDCs are just an outgrowth of the success of crypto. And so, yeah, I mean, this trading currency, whatever it is, this neutral currency, it could easily be digital and backed by these commodities. Mm-hmm. That's not a shocker. You know, I mean, I think the IMF would love that if it could be them. I think that while that's a possibility, I think more likely what's going to happen, I think that, the BRIC countries and Asia in particular, I think they're going to create some type with, you know, China and Russia, in India, and if they can get Japan in there, right now Japan's kind of an outsider for them. Boy, if they could get Japan involved in that, oh my goodness, that would be lights out for the dollar. Mm-hmm. But I think that India China and Russia are the three biggies here that are going to create some type of commodity-based currency, I would expect, in the next couple of years. It all depends on Ukraine, how that unfolds. But I think Asia is going to create some type of a currency. We'll see what unfolds. Now, I don't think that Russia is going to sell their oil and gold. I think they would be more interested in some type of a neutral commodity-based currency because they sell all over the world, and all over the world really doesn't necessarily want the rubles. But I think in the near term, it wouldn't shock me at all if they demanded that Europe buys their oil and gas in rubles. I think that's a possibility. Mm-hmm. But these currency shifts are coming. I think it's kind of pretty obvious that the system's been changing for the last 10, 20 years, where people especially China, has been trying to make deals with other countries where they're not dealing only in dollars. That's been an ongoing theme here for quite a while. Now it's just manifesting at a rapid rate. Mm-hmm.
So as we're kind of on the subject of Bitcoin, Don, how do you see the news of Bitcoin this week, you know, out of Europe, where they made the decision not to kind of outlaw it for the energy expenditure that it needs?
So let's back up. Last week, Biden came out with a presidential executive order saying that the United States wants to help cryptos to be more of invest. He wants people to be entrepreneurs, and he wants crypto to flourish, basically. He basically said the United States, and this kind of didn't get a lot of publicity, but he in that executive order, it basically outlines that the United States wants to support and enhance the development of blockchain and crypto technology. It's like, this is what America does. That was kind of the main point. We don't shy away from new technology. We embrace it. That's huge for the United States. Absolutely huge. Now, Europe this week voted to ban Bitcoin. And that was another one. Now, it was early innings on kind of their crypto legislation, crypto regulations. It was a committee vote. It was, do we want to include it in the bill, if you will? And what they wanted to do is they were trying, the Greens and kind of the more leftist parties were saying that Bitcoin wastes energy. And we're at a point where we don't need to be wasting energy. We don't have enough energy. So we need, and so they wanted to basically make it illegal to use proof of work, which Bitcoin uses, for any cryptocurrencies. But what they don't realize is, and it didn't pass. And so basically Bitcoin dodged a bullet, dodged another bullet. And Bitcoin seems to be pretty good at that. But the one thing about Bitcoin that, and I think that the reason why it didn't pass is because Bitcoin is a revolutionary technology, and it's a technology that has the potential to enhance humanity. And so if you kill Bitcoin, in theory, you're hurting the future of humanity. Now, that might be an argument that, you know, airy fairy type, you know, fantasy type of an argument. But we don't know what Bitcoin is going to bring. For instance, Bitcoin is really the only, in my opinion, the only decentralized crypto. It's the only one. That's the reason why they call all the other, they make fun of everything else. All, you know, is because none of the other cryptos have that type of decentralization that Bitcoin has. For instance, Bitcoin is almost like an AI program, and it runs all by itself. if you want to be a miner, you don't have to ask for permission. If you want to run a node, you don't have to ask permission. There's nobody that oversees it. It's completely done independently. There's no organization of Bitcoin. And then the real key to its decentralization is that nobody can control the chain, the next change to Bitcoin. No organization, nobody. Bitcoin only changes very, very, very slowly. And it changes through a pure system of consensus. Anybody can come up with an idea of what of a new enhancement to Bitcoin, but it doesn't get implemented until the group, the community group, agrees to it and think that is the way Bitcoin should go. It's the only one that can do that. And so it makes it unbelievably potent as this private asset, this private commodity. It can be used as a currency, but that's not what it is. It's a commodity. It's a, basically what I call it is it's a collectible, but it can be used as barter. It can use to back a currency, but it has a lot of value that we're not sure about. And so for to kill it right now, because it uses energy when it might be the most valuable asset on the planet, is a little premature. And they made a right choice. In America, you have to have a reason to say that this commodity doesn't have enough value to have. And so I'm glad that, you know, I think that Bitcoin is going to be a success because of the reasons I just outlined. It's this decentralization aspect of Bitcoin is so potent that Bitcoin should survive.
So why is Japan so important to its success?
Because Japan was the first country to adopt it. And so Japan is the only country, was the first country to basically say, yeah, Bitcoin's a good thing. We're not going to kill this thing. We like it. And the reason why they did that is because of the yen and because of MNT. They weren't sure if they needed a backup plan. Bitcoin is plan B to their financial system, to the yen. And it's the only city, only major city in the world that if you go there, there's Bitcoin signs everywhere. No other city in the world, well, that I'm aware of, major city in the world is like that. Everywhere you look.
Tokyo?
Bitcoin, yeah, Tokyo.
Okay.
Everywhere you look, see Bitcoin signs. It's the only one. So Japan is the reason why South Korea didn't ban Bitcoin. South Korea initially didn't want anything to do with Bitcoin. They tried to ban it. And then somebody said, whoa, 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 no, you don't, because they compete with Japan. They're not going to let Japan have an advantage. So if Bitcoin, if companies start using Bitcoin to do international trade instead of the dollar, for instance, then that's going to give them a competitive advantage because they can bypass banks and they save money on each transaction. Plus, you can use smart contracts to basically do these transactions. And they're like AI. They like basically run on them on their own. So Korea basically, oh, no, 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 we can't, you know, we're not going to do this. I think that China eventually will bring Bitcoin back. Right now, it's basically illegal in China for doing transactions. Mm-hmm. But if Bitcoin is a success in other places, I think that China will bring it back. The one thing about China is that they can do anything they want. They don't have to pass laws. They just do whatever they want. So if they want to make it legal again, boom, it's legal again. It happened tomorrow. So I think eventually, I think China will go back to Bitcoin for international trade. Mm-hmm. Once it gets over six figures, once it gets over 100,000 and companies start using it for international trade, I think China will start using it.
Excellent. So Don, you know, when we look at the mining complex, obviously, you know, running gold stock data, you have a unique insight into this. So are you still looking at silver producers as a great place to be right now? Or where are you seeing the potential in the miners and or explorer sector right now?
I like silver and gold miners both. I prefer producers because I think that producers have more bang for the buck as the price of gold and silver go up. If you're a drill story or you're a development stock and the price of gold goes up, you're not going to get an immediate value. You get a little bit, you know, your gold and the silver in the ground. But if you're a producer, your free cash flow goes up immediately. Mm-hmm. So I focus on being overweight producers. Now, silver, the problem with being, for me, I like to diversify and have a small cost basis, you know, in a lot of stocks because I don't know who the five and 10 baggers are going to be. So I like to own a lot of stocks. And so I keep my cost basis low. For that reason, it's very difficult for me to be like 50% into silver miners because there's just not enough of them. So then I'm going to have these high cost bases. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the best I can do is 30-35% in silver to keep, if I'm going to be true to my investment philosophy, keeping my cost basis down. And see, because you know, there's not enough high quality silver producers out there, and I don't want to have, let's face it, there's no such thing as a safe miner. So I don't want to have, you know, 3% allocations to a single silver miner. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I'm, you know, 1-1.5-2% is kind of my sweet spot for a, you know, quality producer. And so from that perspective, but I want to have exposure. So I own 45 silver stocks. Most people think that's, you know, that's too many. You own way too many, but I own, you know, maybe 100.
The whole sector.
Not the whole sector. There's about 75, and I have in my newsletter, there's about 75 silver names mm-hmm. that I like, that I think are decent. 75. So I own about half of the sector, but yeah, I have full exposure to the silver sector. So if silver goes to 50, 100, I'm going to do really well, but I own more gold stocks and silver stocks because there's many more gold stocks and silvers, many more gold plays and silver plays. There's like, okay. So there, I have 880 stocks in my portfolio. And I only have 77 silver names that I like. So you can see the vast majority of the stocks are gold miners because they're just, silver is more rare than, much more rare than gold. There's just not a lot of, you know, big, you know, silver miners. For instance, in Australia and Canada, there's only one silver miner that mines over 2 million ounces a year. That's considers itself a silver miner. One. That's it. Mm-hmm. They're rare. They're very rare. That mining company is Alexco, which I'm very bullish about.
Mm-hmm. So, Don, you know, by that, let's say that line of thinking, do you like royalty plays as well, considering the cost basis that they have?
Oh, all right. Well, let's stir the pot a little bit. So I like Franco-Nevada, silver, wheat and precious metals, and Sandstorm. I like the big three. I think that those three are all going to perform better than the majors and have really good dividends. The smaller ones are more, have more risk, but for me, it's like, I don't need to take any risk. Those three, but I don't own any of those. But for the private equity firms that I consult for, I basically say, yeah, that you want to own those three stocks mm-hmm. because they're going to do well. Now, the reason why I don't own them, I said I was going to stir the pot a little bit, is that I don't believe in the model for the long term. I'm a long term investor. Now, for next year, if you're only going to own them from 1 year, I think they're great plays, good ways to diversify. I think they're all going to, you know, perform better than the majors. So the majors are going to, I think, go up 2x, and that these royalty plays are probably going to go up 3x is my feeling. And the reason why is because their margins are just huge. And so as the price of gold goes up, you know, they're just going to have huge cash flow, really good, excellent dividend plays. But here's the problem I have with the model. The model, and I always had a problem with it from day one when I first started in investing early 2000s, and I was looking at someone when Silver Wheaton was first formed, Franco-Nevada, the deals that they were making were life of the mine deals. So most of these contracts are life of the mine at a fixed price. So it's one-sided. If the price of gold or silver goes up, the miner gets no additional money, none, zero. It's totally one-sided. I'll give you an example. A lot of these deals that Silver Wheaton made and still today or at $4, they only pay $4 fixed for the life of the mine. $4. It's crazy, right? It's totally one-sided. Silver is already at 25 and they only pay $4. The margins are crazy high. And gold is the same. I mean, you have these really low fixed prices, $400, $350, fixed for the life of the mine. That's how much they pay for this, for the gold or silver. That's it. So they're too one-sided for me. And so what's going to happen, in my opinion, is at a certain point in time, companies are going to basically renege. They're basically going to stop paying. Just like this is the same thing as a union going on strike. A union has a contract. Let's say a union has a contract in Detroit and they're getting paid, you know, $22.50 an hour. And they go on strike and say, we're not working until you give me a raise. We're not working. And the company can't necessarily sue them. So it's not an apples to apples comparison, but it's similar. They're not getting any money. The company's not making any money because they didn't have any workers. Mm-hmm. In the same vein, if you're a royalty company and your company stops paying you, or stops giving you your royalty, you're not making any money. This is the same type of thing. You're not making any money. You got to resolve that problem. Now, in a union situation, they negotiate and they give them a raise and they go back to work, or they fire them and find somebody else. But it ends up being painful for the company, right? Mm-hmm. So the same type of pain can happen to a miner, because if they stop getting paid, their only recourse is to go to court. How long does a court case take to get resolved? Well, if it takes more than 12 months, that's 12 months of revenue. Aren't you going to try to negotiate and get some revenue back? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There's going to be deals that are renegotiated. And once a few start, a lot of them are going to get renegotiated. And that's going to be a hit on these royalty companies, because their margins are going to start going up and their free cash flow multiples are going to start going down. So right now, a typical royalty company has a multiple of 25 to 35, very, very high. I think that those multiples will go down at a certain point in time once it breaks. Now, here's a funny thing. I think that everything I just said is totally logical. But I'm not going to name names, but one of the CEOs of one of these major royalty companies laughed when somebody told them about my theory. He laughed. Now, I don't think it's a laughing. I don't think this is something to laugh about, that the model is so secure that everybody's going to pay. When silver gets to $50, I don't think that Silver Wheaton and we get inflation and they start losing money on every single ounce that they're 25%. Their royalty is 25% with Wheaton, 25%. It's a big one, right? And they don't make any money. They don't make any money. They lose money on 25% of their production. If you're losing 25% and then Wheaton's making $40 plus margins, you're going to go, this is nuts. I'm not paying them, right? Mm-hmm. I think the Alexco one is going to be the first one to break. I'd be shocked. Once we get to $50 silver, I think Alexco stops paying them and says, hey, we want to pay you. We just want this deal to be fair. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's coming. And that's why I don't hold any royalty plays, because I'm more of a long-term, and I'm after five baggers too. I'll take a three bagger. My real focus is on five baggers, and most of your royalty plays are three baggers. Mm-hmm.
So Don, do you think, you know, as we, you're talking about, let's not call it peak silver, but for example, if we see $50 silver, or when we see $50 silver, on the backside of that, do you think that the royalty plays are actually negative for the mining industry as a whole?
Gosh, you're really stirring the pot. Didn't I attack them good enough saying their model is broken? Jeez.
Well, it just seems that, you know, on the downside, that could really, you know, on the upside, they can help provide liquidity, right, to explorers and junior producers. But, you know, that's to get things started. On the downside, it seems like they could accelerate, you know, ending production for some of these mines or companies.
Well, I hate to dig myself a hole. Because again, I kind of like the royalty plays here for this year, maybe next year. It's way out in the future that I worry about. But that said, I'm kind of in the Rob McEwen camp in that he's said that they're net negative for the industry. And the reason why is because a lot of these deals end up hindering the companies instead of helping them. They're net negative because, yes, they create liquidity. Yes, they do loans, but they're generally not good loans. And they basically lock in, you know, if they weren't fixed, they'd be great, you know. The problem is they're fixed. If they started making loans, you know, I'll give you a perfect example. Most of these loans end up having huge interest rates, huge. I mean, because the reason why they're huge is because they're fixed. And so over time, if you do, you know, if you calculate how much interest they actually paid for them, like, I mean, a typical streaming deal is they'll go and they'll pay a company, they'll give a company, you know, $25, $50 million in cash. So here's your money. And now you pay me back in the stream. Now, if you calculate how much money they end up getting back for the life of that mine, and then you look at the margins and you just take a little, you know, back of a napkin, you calculate that out, the interest rates are always just massive. Always. You never see one that, oh, wow, they got a great deal. It's like, I mean, even if the price of silver goes to 35, they're still only paying 5%. No. You never, ever see anything like that. And so the royalty model, I mean, that's the reason why the margins are just incredible. Most of the margins, I've very rarely see a margin under 80%, rarely. They're usually, you know, 85, somewhere in there, 80% plus, huge margins.
Well, that's because they're able to operate with so few employees, right?
Right. So if they're having these huge margins, why don't they make the deals, you know, where they're flexible? It's like, okay, the price of gold goes up, you go up. I haven't seen any of those deals. They're always fixed. It's like Silver Wheaton and Franco Nevada created that model and everybody's followed it. Nobody's created this flex model that says as the price of gold goes up, we will pay you more. And so until that happens, I have to say that, you know, I think it's somewhat net negative for the industry. Somewhat. I don't know to the degree, but somewhat. I'm kind of in the McEwen camp.
Excellent, Don. Well, I think that's a reasonable place to kind of wrap up today's discussion. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on before we do?
Well, the one topic we didn't really get into is Ukraine. I think this is a good place to end because I think this is going to be potentially the key to this gold bull run because since 1945, the dollar has really been the foundation of the global financial system. And I think that Ukraine is breaking that system. We're seeing it before our eyes right now. The sanctions with Russia, I mean, for them to lock out Russia's foreign reserves, I mean, my goodness. I think that we are witnessing a new type of financial system go into place here. And I think it's going to be very, very bullish for gold and silver. And I think we're going to know within the next 2 to 3 months. I might be a little bit too aggressive there. It might be longer than that. But I think we're going to know in the next 2 to 3 months the kind of the momentum behind gold and silver here. If they create some type of a commodity-based neutral currency and put gold inside it, and countries start, you know, buying more gold, we could see a transition point here where gold and silver are finally going to make this kind of once-in-a-generation run where we could see multiples, free cash flow multiples that are kind of, we're talking late 1990s multiples we saw with, you know, with the dot-com era. We could see some really crazy things happen. You know, right now we're seeing 10 multiples of the majors, tens. I think we're going to, I think we could see 30s and 35s. That's nuts. If we see multiples of 30, 35 with the majors average, you're talking about the mid tiers and the juniors having valuations that are, you're going back to the late 70s type things where valuations just go. I mean, it's hard to even fathom the multiples that could happen. I mean, they're so big, I don't even want to mention them. They're just so, you know, you just take today's valuations and, you know, put 2x, 3x, 4x upon them. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what the potential is here because of what Ukraine means to this. I mean, we were already, before Ukraine, before this dollar thing happened, we were already looking at silver going to 100 before. And a fear trade. Now we're looking at that increase on top of it. So things are changing here. And again, I think the next 2 to 3 months, maybe a little longer, we're going to learn kind of the fallout of Ukraine and what it means to gold and silver. But as of now, I think you have to be a little bit bullish. I think we can end it there.
Don, you know, as part of that, you know, we've seen China stacking and buying gold. Obviously, the reported numbers, they're all dramatically low, to be charitable about that. Russia's been buying gold. There's a lot of Eastern Bloc countries that are buying gold. Why do you think that attitude is different in the US? That is, you know, we haven't been buying gold and adding that to the central bank balance sheet or the Fed's balance sheet, sorry.
Right. So it's kind of it's through the looking glass. So in the US, we don't see the problem with the dollar. Mm-hmm. You don't see the problem with the economy. Then why would you accumulate gold? Mm-hmm. The only people that are accumulating gold and silver in the United States is this small group of people.
Fringe minority.
They call the gold bugs and the silver bugs. Mm-hmm. And we have a negative kind of view. People have negative attitudes about us. But if you're on the outside looking in and you're seeing the US exporting treasuries that are losing their value, then I need something else. Mm-hmm. So the Russians were first. They were ahead of the curve. They basically got rid of their treasuries and started hoarding gold. Now, China's probably going to be next. China's been hoarding gold, but they haven't been selling their treasuries. Now they probably will. Mm-hmm. And then Japan is kind of the wild card. Does Japan allow China to sell $1 trillion in treasuries at a profit, possibly, and hold on to theirs and then lose theirs? Is Japan going to allow themselves to be holding the bag? I say no. I say that once China gets their inventory of treasuries down to, let's say, 700, 600 billion, I think Japan starts selling at that point and it exacerbates. I think that China and Japan are going to play a game of chicken here. Once China starts selling, Japan, at a certain point, Japan has to jump in. They cannot stay on the sidelines. And that... It all comes down to Ukraine. That's what started this all in motion. This is the Lehman event. This is the black swan that basically Wall Street is not paying attention to yet. Once they do, that's your fear trade. I've been saying that gold's going to go up $100 in a single day. When that happens, there's your fear trade. That is the day the fear trade begins. Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of $50 days, $75 days. We haven't seen 100 yet. When gold goes up 100, there's your fear trade. And I've been saying the best time to basically get into this bull run is when silver hits 2850. When silver hits 2850 and confirms gold, that is probably the best risk reward opportunity of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, silver should run to 50 within 3 to 6 months. And that's a huge run for miners. And if it keeps going, you're talking about something so epic that nothing will compare to it. It'll make the 1980s look like, you know, and then in the 1980s, silver went up 30 times, I believe 35 times from 1970 to 1980, mm-hmm. 35 times. I think this will be even more epic. Now, silver's not going to go up 35 times, but the miners will. That's going to be your difference. And, you know, nobody was around in the late 70s to make that play. We're here now. But I think silver will go up, you know, 10, I don't think it'll go up 10x, but probably 8x. But if silver goes up 8x, the miners are going to go up 30x. Mm-hmm. That's some really, really once in a lifetime type thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Just have to be patient enough to be there to weather the storm at this point to get to that point, right?
Well, people listening to this, they actually, we've weathered, we've waited. I mean, we went through a 7-year correction from 2012 to 2019, 2013 to 2020. 7-year correction. Mm-hmm. Then we had a 2-month run in silver, 1-year run in gold, and then we had a 17-month correction. So we had basically, that's 8 years. We waited 8 years. The patience is over. Now we're weeks away from 2850. We're weeks away. Our patience, we're there now. We won. Mm-hmm. We won. And now it's just, the bull kicked off a lot of people. A lot of people don't want to touch this stuff. But the people that hung around are going to get rewarded here, I think. Mm-hmm. I think the patience, I think that's kind of over. I think we're there now. Now it's just, now get ready to ride the rocket ship is my feeling. Mm-hmm. But again, just one caveat, it all is going to come down to H2 of this year. Mm-hmm. As bullish as I am, H2 of this year is going to decide the significance of this bull run. Mm-hmm. If inflation goes back down, say sub 5%, and the stock and the Fed is able to inject enough liquidity to prevent a recession, then gold will go back down to 1700, 1750, somewhere in there. And this whole miner thing will be dead. So we're not out of the woods. We got to get to 2850 first. Then we have to see how H2 unfolds. Mm-hmm. Then we'll know. But I think by July, August, September, right in there, I think we're going to know exactly where we are sitting. Mm-hmm. And how bullish this thing looks. Right now it looks great, but we still need to get around the bend. We're kind of going into this thing. We got to just get a little bit around the bend.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. Well, Don, I think that's a good spot on a hopeful note to wrap up here for today. Of course, your website, goldstockdata.com, and you're pretty active on Twitter at Don Durrett, 2 R's, 2 T's. Don, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Tom. Appreciate it.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.